All right, our next case this morning is, did we lose all of our law clerks?
We did.
Here, let's,
Give me a second.
Go ahead and be seated for a second. Go ahead and be seated.
Must have taken our 10 minutes.
Tripped them.
Yeah.
Think that's everybody?
Well, there's some.
All right, let's recommence. This case is 25-2112, Floor versus Board of Regents. Ms. Funk?
May it please the court. My name is Elise Funk with Harrison and Hart, and I represent the appellant, Dr. Floor. In this appeal, Dr. Floor asks this court to overturn the lower court's dismissal of his Title IX claim for sex discrimination and procedural due process violations. The lower court and defendants attempt to characterize the many inconsistencies and procedural irregularities against Dr. Floor as benign, but in doing so, they miss the forest for the trees, and they fail to properly engage in the holistic assessment that takes into consideration the totality of the facts, with all reasonable inferences construed in favor of Dr. Floor. And this is what's required of Doe 2. Notably, we're not asking the court to find that Dr. Floor was in fact discriminated against, or that his due process rights were in fact violated. We are merely asserting that Dr. Floor introduced sufficient evidence where a reasonable juror could find that he was discriminated against, and that there was insufficient process involved in his 1-year suspension from his employment at UNM.
Is our focus here just on, it's on the peer review? Is that the primary wrongdoing in this case?
I believe that it starts at the very beginning, Your Honor, and goes throughout all the process. And so I would like to call the court's attention to the primary major inconsistencies and one-sidedness that I see in all of the procedure. So first and most importantly is the evidence that Dr. Floor was treated more prejudicially than his similarly situated female counterpart, Ms. Chavez. UNM's policy regarding sexual harassment is policy 2740, and it defines sexual harassment in all contexts as unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature, unwelcome conduct. Because all sexual harassment requires unwelcomeness per the policy, an unwelcomeness inquiry is required, regardless of which type of sexual harassment is being investigated, either quid pro quo or hostile work environment. Now, the lower court...
Didn't the district court conclude that OEO did, in fact, conduct a welcomeness
review? Yes, and that is one of the lower court's main errors. The lower court didn't investigate the actual welcomeness assessment, and it erred in finding that the OEO conducted a welcomeness analysis regarding Ms. Chavez's complaint, where it actually just substituted Dr. Flores and Ms. Chavez's roles, their titles, mere titles at UNM, as a replacement for the required welcomeness analysis. UNM was not permitted to replace the required conduct-focused welcomeness inquiry with a mere presumption based merely on power differences based on their titles or their roles at the university. The welcomeness analysis has to be just that, an analysis. It has to be conduct focused. And there is no analysis where the beginning and end of that analysis is, this is your title at the university, you're a professor, this is your title, you're a graduate student, done. And that's what was done here.
How are we in the business of policing the regularity of their process? I mean, this is about discrimination. I mean, whether UNM follow the right procedure or not, whether they have a clunky procedure, whether they should not have presumed the title, although in other contexts, title and power disparity eliminates the need for one party to essentially have consent. You just can't do it. I mean, you just cannot engage in that activity. And so the point I'm getting at is, why does it matter? I mean, what we're supposed to be determining is whether irregularities equal discrimination. So where's the link between the fact that they substituted his title for wokeness inquiry and the fact that in some way he was discriminated against?
Yes, and so the Doe 2 holistic inquiry involves looking at a lot of different factors in the process,
yes.
Looking for irregularities, looking for one-sidedness in based on gender or that cuts along gendered lines. And if there are enough of those one-sided situations, and enough of those one-sided situations cut for one gender or sex versus another, and it's the same, that is enough evidence to go to a jury for the jury to evaluate the totality of the circumstances, which is required by Doe 2, to get to a reasonable inference that sex discrimination played a role in the decision. And so,
what about the title? Kids, the fact that he is a professor and she is a graduate student, what about that is infused with some sort of sexual connotation? I mean, you could have very easily have had a woman who was the professor and a man who was a graduate student. So what makes that a sexual, have any sort of gender connotation to it?
Only in regard to the totality of the circumstances. So we have to look at circumstantial evidence here as to whether or not the gender-neutral reasoning that the UNM defendants give is pretext. And if you get enough of these procedural irregularities, these inequities, and enough of them tilt against the male and for the female, there is enough to go off of there to imply that there is a possible pretext in these gender-neutral reasons. And
but is that really the test? I mean, the test is, I mean, this is one instance. Let's say you had 100, you could catalog 100 irregularities, but if none of them really had sort of any sort of gender relationship, that just means that it was a botched treatment of your client. It doesn't mean anything as it relates to discrimination. I don't think Doe 2 held that. I mean, in Doe 2, there were irregularities, but they had implications for gender, right? I mean, like, for example, the one situation where they didn't interview certain witnesses because that were his witnesses, right?
Right. So basically, when you're looking at circumstantial evidence, you can't just necessarily nitpick at every little thing and try to take it out of the equation. Right.
I thought that you were nitpicking and giving us I thought we were in this holistic examination. We're supposed to be looking at all of these irregularities, right?
Yes. So we can't look at just one in isolation. And I believe that there are enough irregularities that all tilt against my client, the male, and in favor of the female. And they're parallel in posture. However, the male was systematically disadvantaged. And when you have enough of those that add up through the process, there is enough to go to a jury on the issue. I'm not saying that it's definitive, it's summary judgment for our client. I'm saying that our client should have been entitled to go to a jury. And if you look, in addition to policy 2740 requiring a wokeness evaluation, the case Meritor Savings Bank also required UNM to conduct an inquiry into whether the conduct Ms. Chavez complained of was unwelcome, not whether her participation was voluntary. The court distinguished those things. And in deciding that the power differential between Dr. Floor and Ms. Chavez was sufficient for a finding of sexual harassment against Dr. Floor, the OEO and then the lower court wrongly substituted the per se voluntariness finding that has to do with just those titles for the required conduct-based wokeness assessment. And the key here is conduct-based, not just title-based, and assessment. Not simple, we're looking at the titles and moving on. And that's where a lot of the irregularities, a lot of the due process violations also come from. But you can see that there were two complaints submitted, one by a male, one by a female. They were reviewed by the same body. They were reviewed around the same time. They made the same allegations of sex harassment. They were following the same policy. And one got the benefit of that analysis, that fact-based, conduct-based analysis, a deep analysis. And one of them did not. One of them just got, here's the titles, we're done.
I'm sorry to I'm sorry to interrupt. Let me ask this. We're focusing on this particular interaction between, or these two particular individuals. Was it the something more, and that is the language from Doe 2, didn't that focus on systemic issues associated with the university? In other words, how the university went about processing male and female allegations of sexual assault or harassment, all of those things. All that I've heard you talk about to date is the treatment of Ms. Chavez and your client. I mean, do you have any something more as it relates to how the university itself interacted?
Yes, so I believe that the something more is almost akin to a pattern and practice Monell, hear me out, in that the courts have shown that when you're looking for this something more, you can look at policies across, you know, entire state practices or entire department practices. But you can also look at instances within a single case that can form a pattern and practice in and of themselves. And there's case law to that effect. And so here I'm arguing that, yes, Doe 2 did say that there are some broader policy practice, wider, university-wide.
Right, yeah, we looked at the statistical disparities of how students at DU were, the investigations were differential based on the sex of the accuser, right? And this morning you've been focused just on Chavez versus Floor, and is there anything beyond that fact pattern, you know, other additional male professors that were treated differently than our female accusers versus male accusers, you know, or vice versa?
Yes, there are the 13 complaints that we talked about in the briefing that we found, and that 100% of those disciplinary actions were against males. But I would argue that there are enough procedural irregularities within this single series of processes to let the issue go to a jury.
You don't think you need the other 13 to prevail in this case?
The other
accusations involving different professors.
I think that it's telling that 100% of the discriminatory or the disciplinary actions were against men and not against women.
What does that mean? I mean, do you have any statistics that someone attempted to make a complaint against a woman? I mean, I don't understand why that has any meaning whatsoever, that there were 13 complaints and they were all against men. I mean, that doesn't say anything to me.
No, there were 13 complaints. I believe 11 were against men, but 100% of the disciplinary actions taken from those 13 complaints were against men.
But you don't know anything about the two that weren't, and we don't know why they weren't, and we don't know if it had anything to do with that would relate to this case. I mean, I just don't understand what the meaning of the 13 or the 11 is, or how they resulted, or what they mean.
And that's the university-wide data that we were able to get. But mm-hmm. like I said, if there are enough instances where one party is given disparate treatment, and that one party consistently in one party's favored and one party's disfavored consistently throughout the process, that is enough to raise an inference that a reasonable juror could make that there was a sex discrimination occurring here, and that the sex neutral or the neutral reasons given by the UNM defendants, they were just pretext. I would like to save the rest of my time if that's possible.
You may.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jacqueline Woodcock, and I'm here representing the appellees, UNM defendants, here today. We ask the Court to affirm the District Court's two decisions, first by Judge Garcia on the Title IX claims and Judge Parker's decision upholding qualified immunity. I think it's clear in the briefing that there's no evidence that the university made its policy violation determination and sanctioned Professor Floor because of gender bias against males, direct or otherwise. What you do have here is a tenured professor having a very explicit sexual relationship, cyber, but still a sexual relationship with a student, and offering her a job all at the same time and then withdrawing it. And
a question for you. Has the 10th Circuit ever expressly held that Title IX provides a private right of action for employment discrimination? I mean, Doe 1 and Doe 2 were students. We don't have a student here in terms of the plaintiff, Mr. Floor. I mean, so have we ever held that there is a basis for this kind of action?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. I would argue that would be their burden of proof, and I'm not aware that that is the case. And I can distinguish, this is not a Doe 2 case. I mean, in a lot of different ways. When you look at Doe 2, you have a he said, she said. Doe 2 and Doe 1 are sexual assault cases between two students. The first big difference here is you've got a tenured professor versus a student. And the power differential was key here. It was not male versus female. The other differentiation here that's huge is it's not a he said, she said, like Doe 2 or even Doe 1. Here you've got exactly what happened in black and white. We've got over 5,000 emails and 185 text messages between Professor Flora and the complainant that exactly tell their story. And the OEO, the Office of Equal Opportunity, had that. Nobody challenged the authenticity of those communications. And that's what the decision was based on. It was based on this power dynamic where the tenured professor had a student looking for a job, and his actions were inappropriate here. The university has an interest in preventing and addressing the situation where a professor engages in a sexual affair with a student and leverages a tangible employment opportunity, which is the job here.
Well, you do have a similarity with Doe 2 in that you were under, your university was under investigation, or under supervision, I should say, by DOJ, right? For failing to respond to allegations of sexual assault. And I understand this isn't an allegation as such of sexual assault, but it is sexual harassment. It's in the same sort of genre of allegation. So the idea being that because you're under investigation, perhaps you handled this case differently because you were under pressure. And so I do think there's some similarity here. What about the fact that you had the department head looking at this and deciding what the sanctions were, even though she was conflicted, and you didn't remove her until she and said she was conflicted until after she had proposed a much less sanction than he eventually receives. No suspension at all, in fact. And then you removed her after that, basically said, yeah, well, she's conflicted, but she'd been conflicted all along. What about that? Why isn't that the something more that might show some sort of, that this pressure you were under might have motivated you to act differently?
Well, I'd like to address both points. First, the mentioning of the DOJ, that is not an issue here because it's like Doe 1. The DOJ investigation, the agreement was for the university to do a better job of looking at and addressing sexual assaults.
Right.
It's facially neutral. It's not a male or female issue at all. It's the same like the Board of Education order that was addressed, or the letter in Doe 1. As far as conflicting out Dr. Rogers, that was a process. And, you know, as things started building up, it became very clear that she had a conflict.
Well, it was clear in the beginning, wasn't it, that she had a conflict?
Well, I think it became more clear as things
went on. Communicated with him, she had advocated for him. I mean, she was talking to him during the process. My understanding is they realized she had a conflict. They just didn't do anything about it till she came up with her suggestion for,
you know,
discipline.
Your Honor, I think the way this was occurring is that as each piece of information was going on, the Vice Provost was trying to address the situation and figure out, you know, how do we stay as true as we can to the process, but realizing, okay, this person has a conflict. And when the proposed sanction was also reviewed by the Title IX coordinator, which is not prohibited. That is not a procedural irregularity. There's no policy prohibiting that. In fact, it's part of the OEO's process. She realized that that was not appropriate. And so we've got, even removing Dr. Rogers, that was not inappropriate under the policy. The policy makes very clear, even in defining department chair, that that can be a vice dean of another non-departmental school. And so when she was replaced, by Dr. Carey, and that was totally permitted by the policy. That was not an irregularity here, nor was what they cite involving the Title IX coordinator, nor is the DOJ's focus, which was facially neutral. One thing I do want to pick up on, which,
did Ms. Chavez complain about the conflict?
She did. She complained that Dr. Rogers would be involved in sanctioning when she felt that Dr. Rogers was aware of the complainant's complaint and didn't refer that on like she referred Professor Flores, that she was kind of in Professor Flores' camp and did not take the same action on her behalf. So there was no question there was a conflict and that she needed to be removed, but what it is, it's not a procedural irregularity. And what we have here, when we start looking at Doe 2, I would argue that the procedural irregularities there were huge. And it's different in the sense that that was a focus because, one, you had a he said, she said. So they were trying to figure out what's going on, not only with the facts, but what's going on in the university. Here we have it in black and white. Here there's not a question of the facts. Here we have it right before us. Besides that, when you start talking about the statistics, you look at Doe 2, you have a situation where I think your honors were addressing where in Doe 2, they didn't investigate any of the complaints that were brought by the men against the females. Here it's very different. Of the 11, for example, that were being discussed by opposing counsel, five of those were found to have violated the policies, but six of those were not. So you could argue that the facts really do matter. Over 50% of the statistics or the cases were found no violation. And so I don't think, you know, their statistics here are very vanilla. It doesn't get them there. It's not a sex bias type thing. Likewise, we have no information whether the claims brought by males against females were apples to apples. We don't know what happened with those. We have no information. We have nothing to show, like in Doe 2, that these were some kind of conscious choices of the university not to address something like they showed in Doe 2. One of the other things that they brought up that I want to address here is, and I do think it's addressed very well in the district court case, is that the OEO did look at all the facts. It did look at everything before it on the two complaints. And there were two complaints, but they were very different here. I would beg to differ that they were not the same. Not only are their statuses not the same, but their complaints were not the same. You have the complainant bringing a hostile work environment case, and you've got, the complainant bringing a quid pro quo retaliation case, and you've got Professor Floor bringing a hostile work environment, which have different tests. And if you look at the policy,
Was Ms. Chavez interviewed by OEO?
Yes, she was interviewed by OEO, as was Professor Floor. And I think it's really important to focus on the fact that before we even get to this, you know, his one-year suspension and the affirmance by the peer review council, he went through an extensive process. Both of them did. So by the time you got there, the OEO investigator had interviewed both of them, prepared written statements, sent them to them, let them correct the statement, got that back, issued another finding or another report with no findings, let them provide additional evidence, then issued the PLOD, the preliminary letter of determination, gave them yet another opportunity to correct it, provide more information, issued the final decision, and then had the opportunity to appeal, which Professor Flora did to the president, which affirmed. had yet another appeal to the Board of Regents, which declined. And then there was a sanction process where he had an opportunity to provide an impact statement. That was again reviewed by the dean. And then you have this peer review hearing. So by the time all of this is happening, there is an amazing amount of process, sufficient due process here, which I think supports Judge Parker's decision as well. So I think that that needs to be remembered, and the OEO went through all of the emails. I would encourage the court, time permitting later, to look at the emails, look at all the texts and the communication on the job offer. Look at 116, 117, 444 to 445, discussion about she wanted this job. Yeah, she talked about the hours and the pay and whatever, and you know, but she wanted to get this job. She wanted to talk about it and finalize it. There was talk with the office about a contract. And then there's a lot of sexual emails, all very explicit, all interwoven in this whole time frame. And I would ask the court, look at the emails from Professor Floor about having sex in his office. Look at 256. Look at the other emails that are more explicit.
Ms. Woodcock, could I ask you, in this process of correcting statements that you alluded to, is there any allegation that you're aware of that the investigator somehow or other tried to slant or misrepresent the statements of Professor Floor in that process?
I'm not aware of anything like that, Your Honor, and I don't think that would be an issue because, again, we have over 5,000 communications in black and white of what was said between the two of them. If you read the plod and the flawed, those are summarized and outlined in there. And so it's very clear the dialogue that went on between these two people.
The investigator could characterize the objective emails in a certain light that made them worse than they might otherwise appear. So, I mean, it's possible that there could have been a spin on it. And I guess what I take from your answer is that there's been no allegation to that effect.
I'm not aware of anything like that, Your Honor. I really am not. And then, you know, when we look at the other allegations and you talk about, you know, quid pro quo, it is different. And even the OEO looked at this and found that, you know, the OEO looked at welcomeness. If you look at page 46 as part of the plod, they address that. They do talk about the hierarchy and the disproportionate power. But they come down and say, you know, a reasonable college student in complainant's position would feel pressure to please a person in respondent's professional position. Respondent's reliance on complainant's flirtations, apparent consent, and her failure to ask him to stop such communication ignores the inherent power he possesses to affect her employment and possibly her education. And that's what it comes down to. He had the power here. And, you know, consent, it's hard to really figure out, and that's what the OEO said, and that's what the court said, when you've got a power differential of this magnitude, and there's a quid pro quo claim, because that's part of the exchange. Really quickly, I would like to just address, again, there was sufficient process here. I think the district court and the OEO addressed the arguments made by a professor. He was not denied any due process rights here. There was no unfairness to have Dr. Carey represent UNM, and he also alleges that he should have been able to reopen the OEO and findings and cross-examine complainant. But as we've demonstrated, there was an amazing amount of process both pre and post deprivation here, and he was provided sufficient due process in both the OEO and the peer review hearing.
Thank you, counsel. Your time's expired. Ms. Funk, you have something
to add? Thank you.
Just briefly, my time is short. The opposing counsel admits that consent is hard to figure out, and that touches precisely on one of the main errors here. The extensive process discussed means nothing if it's not substantive. There was no substantive welcomeness analysis. There was no opportunity for Dr. Floor to challenge the findings of fact, which is key. All the process never addressed the findings of fact, which opposing counsel admitted is hard to figure out. That's precisely why due process is required for these hard issues here. He also, Dr. Floor, never got the opportunity to confront his accuser. And that's important because he should have been allowed to test her understanding of their communications, her interpretation of their communications, as to whether Ms. Chavez really interpreted them as making her job offer contingent on her continuing these flirtations. You may not like Mr. Floor's communications, but that does not mean that he should have been suspended for a year without the opportunity to work for more than 39 days within that year, and that was discretionary, that was added. He was attempted to be pushed out by basically being prevented from doing any other job for that year. And that is a big enough issue where more process was needed, especially when consent is hard to figure out. Notably,
has the 10th Circuit ever recognized explicitly an employment discrimination case based upon Title IX, that Title IX provides a private right of action for an employment discrimination case?
I have none to cite to you right now, Your Honor, but I would really note that Dr. Rogers, she was only removed from this process after making her disciplinary recommendation. The UNM defendants didn't like the conclusion, so they decided to start over. That is a big alarm bell that should be going off right now. We also know that there were procedure irregularities because multiple policies at UNM were changed after Dr. Floor's discipline to align with the ways that his procedure violated the previous policies. So we know there were multiple irregularities, and that's my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel excused, and the case is submitted.